Providence doctors had been agitating for a general-purpose hospital as early as 1851, but it wasn't until wounded Civil War veterans started returning home in 1863 that the General Assembly chartered the Rhode Island Hospital Corporation. The City of Providence donated a 12-acre site on Eddy Street, where a Siemens hospital once stood. It took 5 years to raise funds and erect a $400,000 red brick turreted building that overlooked pastoral grounds with the Providence River in the distance. A cobbler with a tooth abscess became the first patient on October 6, 1868. Medicine was in its infancy. Doctors knew nothing of the germ theory, but cleanliness, fresh air, and nutrition were emphasized. Lacking most modern medicine, nurses kept patients comfortable until the illness passed or didn't. At Rhode Island Hospital, the average stay in 1868 was 47 days. George Wunderlich, director of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, says nurses, more than doctors, would have saved patients' lives in the hospital's earliest years.
Quite frankly, it was the nurses in the 19th century that saved a lot of patients simply by making sure that things like hydration, sanitation, and diet were properly delivered. But there were also a number of operations that were being done at the time, and in fact, for some conditions, they actually had relatively decent medications, depending on what it was, for certain types of illness, and those would have been administered there.
Wunderlich says your chances of surviving a stay at Rhode Island Hospital in those early years were pretty good.
General hospitals that we find in the Civil War have mortality rates under 8%, some of them under 6%, which when you consider many hospitals today are at 4 and 5%, it's really quite good.
From the beginning to the present, Rhode Island Hospital has been a refuge for the poor. According to a history of the hospital entitled To Meet These Wants by Joseph Garland, it charged no fee at all until 1933. Then it was a modest 10 cents a visit, but laboratory services and drugs remained free. How did it survive? Well, the City of Providence paid for the care of some of its indigent citizens, and a bank called the Rhode Island Hospital Trust Company was created. It funneled a portion of its profits to the fledgling hospital, building, in time, a healthy endowment. State historian laureate Patrick Conley notes that Rhode Island lagged behind Boston, Hartford, and New Haven, Connecticut in the establishment of a general hospital.
Rhode Island lagged behind, and Providence lagged behind, despite the urging of a number of doctors. In 1811, Brown University established a medical school. The medical school lasted until 1827. Had that medical school stayed in operation, Rhode Island Hospital might have been founded a couple of decades before it eventually was founded.
From the start, Rhode Island Hospital has been growing. With the tick-tock of a grandfather's clock, here are some highlights. In 1879, the first telephone was installed, a five-party line at an annual cost of $22. In 1882, a nursing school was formed. It would disband in 1973. In 1892, the marriage of an old city vehicle and a hired horse formed the nucleus of an ambulance service. The dawn of the 20th century brought anesthesia and x-ray departments. In 1914, Rhode Island Hospital became one of the first in the nation to have an electrocardiograph machine. During the 1918 influenza epidemic, it was inundated with close to 1,400 patients in a four-month period. The 1920s were a period of robust expansion, with the addition of dormitories for male and female employees, a laboratory, library, and auditorium. But the 1931 opening of a dental clinic marked a depression-induced lull in the building boom. In 1932, the hospital board ordered wages and salaries cut by 10%. Ward rates were $21 a week, but most patients were admitted free. They simply had no money to pay. During World War II, nearly half the hospital's doctors entered the military. Retired doctors were recalled to active duty, and volunteer groups were formed to carry on the work of the absent. By war's end, the lack of an affiliation with a medical school was taking its toll. Virtually no research was being conducted, and a Boston inferiority complex had set in. In 1948, the hospital added the word research to its mission. A decade later, it was celebrating that commitment with the opening of the George Building, dedicated to cancer research. But its biggest break happened in 1963, when Brown resurrected its medical school. Rhode Island Hospital President Dr. Timothy Babineau says Brown has affiliations with 7 hospitals, but none that rise to the level of its relationship with his.
It is the principal teaching hospital for Brown Medical School, our academic partner. We received that designation a couple of years ago. Brown recognized that although it has many teaching hospitals, Rhode Island Hospital plays a unique role in its academic mission. We are the Level 1 Trauma Center for the city and the region. We are the burn center for the city and the region. We have the only children's hospital here. The open heart surgery program is located here. And we have the tripartite mission of not only providing superb clinical care, but also creating new knowledge through research and educating the next generation of caregivers. That's really a unique tripartite mission. Layer on top of that, that for 150 years, we have never turned away anybody, irrespective of their ability to pay for the services, and we never will. That also makes us unique in the community.
Through the years, Rhode Island Hospital has trained thousands of doctors. They include William P. Murphy, a 1920 intern who received the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology for work on pernicious anemia, and William McDonald, who served as President Franklin Roosevelt's neurologist for treatment of polio. Dr. Walter Thayer, a semi-retired gastroenterologist, interned at Rhode Island Hospital starting in 1954.
Only a few antibiotics available then. There was penicillin, sulfur, isoniazid, streptomycin, and tetracyclines. That's all we had. Now we're over a couple of hundred antibiotics. All these cardiac medications that we use today, like beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, hadn't been existed. We used digitalis and morphine for patients in heart failure.
He lived in a men's dormitory, which provided unique access to the nurses.
And we had tunnels. We knew how to get nurses into the nurses' dorm through the tunnels.
Tending patients wasn't his only job.
One of the jobs was to get rid of bats. At night, bats used to fly around there, and patients would get all upset, and we had these huge bat nets, and we'd try to catch the bats and let them out, because they'd just come back in.
Nurse Kathleen Mezzanotti recalls the spirit of cooperation after the station nightclub fire in 2003.
It would give you chills. It was just unbelievable how the doctors, everybody pitched in, whether you were a doctor, housekeeping, nursing, dietary, anybody. You know, doctors were emptying laundry bins. We all just chipped in. It was just incredible.
So what's the future of Rhode Island Hospital as it marks its sesquicentennial year? Hospital President and CEO Timothy Babineau has concerns about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, but is confident the hospital will carry on.
Healthcare reform is a real hurricane out there. The ability of Rhode Island Hospital to continue to fulfill its tripartite mission, even as the number of folks who can't pay for our services increases. Last year, we provided tens of millions of dollars in charity care, which again is part of our mission, but we need an operating margin to be able to fund the research and the teaching, and that's going to become increasingly challenged. Although sometimes I lie awake at night worrying about these things, I also take great comfort in the fact that Rhode Island Hospital has survived much bigger challenges over the last 150 years, and it's still here, and I suspect it'll be here for another 150 years.
Thousands of poor Rhode Islanders, past and present, would say amen to that. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.